A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a layered question. He's pointing at Maslow's pyramid, that old psychology class staple, and asking, how much agreement is there actually on what counts as a basic human need? How has that understanding changed? And then the real punch. If you had to point to the single biggest gap right now, globally, between what people have and what we accept as the baseline for human potential to flourish, which basic need would it be? So we're not just doing theory here. We're doing theory plus a global audit.
The audit part is where this gets genuinely interesting, because there are two completely different conversations people think they're having when they talk about basic needs. One is the psychology conversation, what a human organism requires to not just survive, but become a fully realized person. The other is the development economics conversation, what metrics you track to know whether humanity is failing or succeeding. They overlap, but they're not the same thing, and the gap between them is where a lot of policy nonsense lives.
Before we even get to the biggest gap, we should probably map what the agreement actually looks like. Because my sense is, Maslow's pyramid has become one of those ideas that's more famous than understood, like Schrödinger's cat or the butterfly effect. Everyone can sketch the triangle. Nobody's read the fine print.
And the fine print matters enormously here. Abraham Maslow published his Hierarchy of Needs in a 1943 paper called A Theory of Human Motivation, and the version most people know, the five-layer pyramid with physiological needs at the bottom, then safety, then love and belonging, then esteem, then self-actualization at the top. That pyramid shape was never actually drawn by Maslow. It was a management textbook innovation from the 1960s that he later disavowed.
The pyramid was a management consultant's PowerPoint slide before PowerPoint existed. Of course it was.
Maslow's original framework was much more fluid. He never used the word pyramid or hierarchy in the rigid sense. He talked about prepotency, the idea that more basic needs generally dominate consciousness until they're reasonably satisfied, but he was explicit that the order isn't fixed. You can have a starving artist pursuing self-actualization while physiological needs go unmet. The hierarchy was descriptive, not prescriptive.
Which means the very diagram people use to argue about basic needs is itself a distortion of what the guy actually said. That's almost too perfect.
It gets better. Maslow kept revising the model until his death in 1970. Late in his career, he added a sixth layer above self-actualization, self-transcendence, the need to connect to something beyond the self. He was influenced by Viktor Frankl's work on meaning, by his own studies of peak experiences. The five-layer pyramid that's burned into every psychology textbook is basically the 1954 version, frozen in amber.
The foundational text on human needs is a frozen draft of a living theory that the author himself moved past, packaged into a shape he never drew, by people who weren't psychologists. This is the intellectual equivalent of building a cathedral on a napkin sketch.
Yet the core insight has proved remarkably durable. Strip away the pyramid branding and ask what the research actually says, and there's broad convergence on a few things. First, that humans do have innate needs that are cross-cultural and not purely constructed. Second, that some needs are indeed more fundamental than others in the sense that chronic deprivation of them makes it nearly impossible to pursue higher goals. Third, that the relationship isn't a simple staircase, it's more like a web or a dynamical system.
Let's talk about that convergence. Who else has weighed in on this beyond Maslow?
The two biggest alternative frameworks are Manfred Max Neef's theory of fundamental human needs and Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum's capabilities approach. Max Neef was a Chilean economist who spent years working in impoverished communities across Latin America, and he came up with a radically different taxonomy. He argued that human needs are finite, few, and universal across all cultures and historical periods. What changes is how they're satisfied, the satisfiers. So the need for subsistence is universal, but one culture satisfies it through rice agriculture and another through hunting seals. The need for identity is universal, but one culture satisfies it through clan membership and another through career achievement.
That's a useful distinction. Separating the need from the satisfier, it means you can critique a society's way of meeting needs without claiming the needs themselves are culturally constructed.
Max Neef identified 9 fundamental needs: subsistence, protection, affection, understanding, participation, leisure, creation, identity, and freedom. And he argued they're not hierarchical at all. They're simultaneous, complementary, and often in tension. You can't say subsistence is more important than identity because losing your identity can destroy your will to subsist.
The hunger striker problem. If needs were strictly hierarchical, hunger strikes wouldn't work. The fact that someone will starve themselves for a political or identity-based need tells you the hierarchy is more of a suggestion.
And that's where Sen and Nussbaum come in. Their capabilities approach shifts the question from what do people need to what are people actually able to do and be. Instead of listing needs, they list central capabilities, things like being able to live a normal length life, having bodily health and integrity, being able to use your senses and imagination, having emotional attachments, exercising practical reason, affiliating with others, relating to nature, playing, and having control over your political and material environment.
Which sounds less like a needs list and more like a description of what a flourishing human life looks like. It's almost Aristotelian.
It's explicitly Aristotelian. Nussbaum has said she's reviving Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, human flourishing, and asking what social conditions make it possible. The capabilities approach has been enormously influential in development economics. The UN's Human Development Index was directly inspired by Sen's work. When you hear people say GDP is a terrible measure of human well-being and we should track health, education, and political freedom instead, that's the capabilities approach talking.
That connects back to the question about the biggest gap. Because if you're using a capabilities framework, you're not just asking who's hungry. You're asking who can't exercise agency, who can't participate in community life, who can't play. The gaps get less visible, but arguably more profound.
And this is where I want to push back slightly on the framing of the question. The question asks about the biggest delta between what people have and what we accept as the baseline for human potential to flourish. But what we accept as the baseline is itself contested. There's a minimalist camp that says basic needs are clean water, enough calories, basic shelter, and primary health care, essentially survival plus. And there's a maximalist camp that says if you can't participate in your society without shame, your basic needs aren't met. Adam Smith made this point in 776. He said a linen shirt was a necessity in 18th century Britain because without one, you couldn't appear in public without disgrace.
The linen shirt test. So a basic need isn't just biological, it's whatever your society requires for dignified participation, which means the baseline moves as societies develop.
And that makes the global gap question harder to answer because the baseline isn't uniform. A child in rural Chad and a child in central London have different requirements for dignified participation. But if we're talking about the most fundamental, cross-culturally agreed upon baseline, the things without which human potential is simply off the table, I think there's actually remarkable convergence.
Walk me through that convergence. What's on the list that pretty much everyone agrees on?
I'd say there are 4 domains where the agreement is rock solid across Maslow, Max Neef, Sen, Nussbaum, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and basically every major framework. First, adequate nutrition and clean water, the subsistence floor. Second, basic physical safety, freedom from violence, from war, from persecution. Third, some form of shelter and protection from the elements. Fourth, access to basic health care, especially maternal and child health. Those 4 show up in every serious taxonomy of human needs.
After those 4, the agreement starts to fray?
It gets fuzzier. Education is on almost everyone's list, but there's debate about how much. Is literacy the threshold, or numeracy, or critical thinking? Social belonging appears in most frameworks, but it's hard to operationalize. Political freedom and agency show up in the capabilities approach, but are conspicuously absent from some simpler needs models. And then there's dignity, which is either the foundation of everything or too vague to measure, depending on who you ask.
If we accept those 4 as the consensus floor, nutrition and water, physical safety, shelter, basic health care, which one has the biggest gap right now? And I mean gap in the specific sense the question asks, the delta between what people actually have and the accepted baseline for flourishing.
I've been thinking about this, and I want to make a case that might seem counterintuitive. Most people, if you ask this question cold, would say hunger. And hunger is enormous. The FAO's most recent data shows somewhere around 735 million people facing chronic undernourishment, which is about 9% of the global population. The number had been declining for decades. Then COVID and the Ukraine war disrupted food supply chains and it spiked back up. We lost years of progress.
Hunger's the obvious answer, but you said counterintuitive.
I think the biggest gap right now, the one where the delta between current reality and even a minimal baseline for human flourishing is largest, is basic physical safety. Specifically, the number of people living in active conflict zones or under regimes where violence is a daily structuring fact of life.
Make that case. Because hunger feels more measurable. You can count calories, you can count bodies. Safety feels squishier.
It's less squishy than you'd think. The UN Refugee Agency reported that by the end of 2025, over 130 million people were forcibly displaced. Refugees, internally displaced people, asylum seekers. That's more than the entire population of Mexico. These aren't people who are merely poor or hungry. These are people for whom the basic assumption that you won't be killed in your sleep has broken down. And that number has been climbing steeply for over a decade. Syria, Ukraine, Sudan, Myanmar, the Sahel, Gaza. The geography of active conflict has expanded dramatically.
Displacement is just the tip of the spear. For every person who flees, there are many more who stay in place while violence structures their lives.
The World Bank's fragility data suggests something like 1 billion people live in areas affected by high-intensity conflict or organized violence. That's 1 in 8 humans. And here's the thing about safety as a need. When it's unmet, it doesn't just create its own deprivation. Conflict zones produce food insecurity because farmers can't plant and markets can't function. They collapse healthcare systems because clinics get bombed and doctors flee. They make education impossible because schools become targets. Safety is the need that, when withdrawn, takes other needs with it.
That's the prepotency argument Maslow is making. Just apply it to collective rather than individual psychology. If your physical safety is under constant threat, you can't pursue belonging or esteem or self-actualization. But you also can't reliably pursue nutrition or health either. It's the deprivation that eats other deprivations.
We're seeing this play out in real time. Look at what's happened in Sudan since the civil war erupted in 2023. Before the war, Sudan had made genuine progress on hunger indicators. Within 18 months, famine conditions were declared in multiple regions. Not because the land stopped producing food, because armed groups made food distribution impossible, the safety gap created the hunger gap.
Your argument is that safety is the bottleneck need right now. The one where closing the gap would have the largest cascading positive effects on other needs.
I think so. And I want to be careful here, because I'm not saying hunger isn't devastating or that we should deprioritize food security. The question asked about the biggest delta, and I think safety wins on two metrics. First, absolute numbers. The number of people whose safety is catastrophically compromised is historically high and rising. Second, severity of deprivation. When your safety is gone, it's not that you have less of a need met. It's that the need is actively, violently unmet in a way that forecloses everything else.
There's also an asymmetry in how we talk about these gaps. Hunger gets quantified. The FAO publishes numbers. The UN sets targets. We can track kilocalories per capita. Safety gets narrated. We tell stories about conflicts, but we don't have a single globally accepted metric for, are you safe? The way we have one for, are you malnourished?
That's a really important point. The hunger metrics are imperfect, but they exist. The WHO and UNICEF have reasonably good data on water access and child mortality. We count bodies after the fact, conflict deaths, homicide rates. But we don't have a good measure of the subjective experience of safety, the way fear of violence constrains behavior, the slow erosion of agency that comes from living under threat.
Even the body counts are contested. Different methodologies produce wildly different numbers for the same conflict. It's hard to close a gap you can't agree on the size of.
There was an interesting attempt to fix this. The Global Peace Index, published by the Institute for Economics and Peace. They try to quantify safety across multiple dimensions, ongoing conflict, militarization, societal safety, and security. Their most recent report found that global peacefulness has declined in something like 13 of the last 17 years. The trend line is unambiguous and it's bad.
If safety is the biggest gap, what does closing it even look like? You can ship food to a famine zone. You can drill wells for clean water. You can distribute mosquito nets. What's the equivalent intervention for physical safety?
This is where the capabilities approach becomes useful because it reframes the question. You don't distribute safety the way you distribute vitamin supplements. Safety is an emergent property of institutions, functioning legal systems, accountable security forces, political settlements that make violence unnecessary. The intervention isn't a product, it's a process. Peacekeeping operations, diplomatic mediation, justice system reform, economic development that makes joining a militia less attractive than getting a job.
Which makes it a much harder problem to solve, and a much harder problem to fundraise for. Buy a child a bed net is a compelling pitch. Support institutional capacity building in fragile states makes people's eyes glaze over.
Yet the cost of not doing it is astronomical. The World Bank estimated a few years back that conflict-driven displacement costs the global economy something like $20 billion annually in lost output, humanitarian response, and long-term development setbacks. That's probably an underestimate. And it doesn't capture the human cost, the generations of children who grow up with trauma, the social capital destroyed, the cultural heritage lost.
Let me push on something. You made the cascading deprivation argument that safety is the need that, when unmet, takes other needs down with it. But couldn't you make the same argument for nutrition? A chronically malnourished child has impaired cognitive development, which affects their ability to get an education, which affects their economic prospects, which affects their children's nutrition. The cascade runs in both directions.
You absolutely could. And I should be clear, I'm not claiming safety is uniquely cascading. All basic needs deprivation cascades, that's what makes them basic. I'm claiming that right now, in the current global moment, safety has the largest absolute gap and the most severe deprivation profile. But reasonable people can disagree on this, and I want to hear your take.
I think you've made a strong case for safety, but I want to float a different candidate, partly because I think it's under-discussed and partly because it cuts across all the frameworks we've been talking about in an interesting way. I think the biggest gap might be in what Sen and Nussbaum call affiliation, the ability to live with and toward others, to participate in community life, to have the social basis of self-respect and non-humiliation.
That's a fascinating pick. It's also the hardest to measure.
But hear me out. If you look at the major global trends of the last few decades, a lot of them point toward a crisis of affiliation. Rising loneliness. The WHO declared loneliness a global health priority back in 2023, with some studies suggesting it's as damaging to health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Political polarization that's shredding social trust. The atomization that comes with digital life. Mass displacement that tears people from their communities. Even in wealthy countries where nutrition, shelter, and physical safety are largely secured, you see an epidemic of social disconnection.
The counter-argument would be that loneliness in wealthy countries isn't in the same category as starvation or violence. It's a real problem, but calling it a basic needs gap dilutes the concept.
Is it dilution, though? If we take the capabilities approach seriously, the question isn't, what's the most physically painful deprivation? It's what deprivation most thoroughly prevents human flourishing. And there's a growing body of evidence that social disconnection does exactly that. It correlates with depression, addiction, suicide, cognitive decline. It erodes the very capacity to pursue other goals. A lonely person with a full stomach and a safe apartment is still, in a meaningful sense, not flourishing.
I think you're onto something, but I'd reframe it slightly. Rather than saying affiliation is the biggest gap, I'd say it's the most neglected gap in policy conversations. We have global institutions and funding mechanisms for hunger, for health, for water, even for education. We have nothing comparable for social connection. It's not even on the dashboard.
The UN has a special rapporteur on the right to food, a special rapporteur on the right to health, a special rapporteur on adequate housing. There's no special rapporteur on the right to not be crushingly lonely.
Maybe there should be, but I want to bring this back to the global scope of the question. If we're looking at the biggest delta worldwide, I still think safety edges out affiliation, simply because the absolute number of people whose safety is catastrophically compromised is so vast, and the consequences are so total. But you've convinced me that affiliation belongs in the conversation, in a way that most basic needs discussions completely overlook.
Let's talk about the evolution piece of the question. How has our understanding of basic needs changed over the years? We've already covered Maslow's own evolution and the shift to capabilities thinking.
Three big shifts, I think. The first is the move from expert-defined needs to participatory approaches. For most of the 20th century, basic needs were defined by Western academics and international institutions. Here's what these people need, we've decided. Starting in the 1990s, there was a push, led partly by the World Bank, but also by NGOs and social movements, to actually ask people what they needed. The Voices of the Poor study from 2000 was a landmark. They interviewed 60,000 people across 60 countries about their experience of poverty and well-being.
What did those 60,000 people say that the experts hadn't?
A few things. One, they emphasized security and stability over simple income. It wasn't just, I need more money. It was, I need to know that my income won't disappear tomorrow. Two, they talked a lot about dignity and respect. Being poor wasn't just about material deprivation. It was about being treated as less than human by officials, by employers, by neighbors. Three, they emphasized household and community well-being over individual well-being. The individualistic framing of needs that's baked into Western psychology didn't match how many people actually experienced their lives.
That third point is huge. Maslow's hierarchy is deeply individualistic. It's about one person's journey from physiological needs to self-actualization. But for much of the world, the relevant unit isn't the individual, it's the household or the community. Your needs are met through relationships, not in isolation.
That's where Max Neef's framework has an advantage, because he explicitly modeled needs as existing within a social matrix. You don't satisfy your need for identity by yourself. You do it through belonging to a group, through cultural participation, through roles and relationships. The individual satisfaction model is culturally specific, not universal.
What's the second big shift?
The second is the environmental turn. Early basic needs frameworks were largely silent on the natural environment. It was just the backdrop against which needs were met. Over the past two decades, there's been growing recognition that environmental stability is itself a basic need, or at least a precondition for meeting all other needs. You can't have food security without stable climate and healthy soil. You can't have clean water without functioning watersheds. You can't have shelter when sea levels are rising.
This creates an interesting tension because some of the ways we've been meeting basic needs, industrial agriculture for food, concrete and steel for shelter, fossil fuels for energy, are actively undermining the environmental conditions those same needs depend on. The satisfiers are eating the substrate.
That's a perfect way to put it. And it's the central challenge of sustainable development. How do you meet the basic needs of 8 billion people without destroying the systems that make meeting those needs possible? It's not a trivial question, and a lot of the UN Sustainable Development Goals are basically trying to square that circle.
The third shift?
The third is the recognition of mental and psychological needs as basic, not secondary luxuries. For most of the 20th century, the implicit model was, first, meet material needs, then worry about psychological well-being. That's the hierarchy in its crudest form. But the evidence now strongly suggests that psychological well-being isn't something you get around to after material needs are satisfied. It's co-constitutive. Maternal depression, for example, has measurable effects on child nutrition and development. Trauma impairs economic productivity. Social trust is a predictor of GDP growth. The mind-body distinction that underlies the material-first model doesn't hold up empirically.
This connects back to your point about safety and my point about affiliation. Both of those have major psychological dimensions. Safety isn't just the absence of physical harm, it's the subjective experience of being secure. Affiliation isn't just having people around, it's feeling connected and valued. These are psychological states with material consequences.
and the implications for policy are significant. If psychological well-being is a basic need, then mental health care isn't a luxury for rich countries, it's a core development priority. Trauma recovery programs in conflict zones aren't secondary to food distribution, they're part of the same package. Social protection systems that preserve dignity aren't just nicer, they're more effective.
Let's loop back to the original question and try to land this. If someone put a gun to your head and said, pick the single biggest basic needs gap globally right now, what's your answer?
I'm going to stick with safety, but with a caveat. The caveat is that safety, as I'm using it, isn't just the narrow absence of violence. It's what the capabilities approach calls bodily integrity. Freedom from violence, but also security in your home, protection from arbitrary state action, the ability to move through the world without constant fear. And I think the numbers bear this out. Between displaced populations, conflict-affected populations, and people living under regimes where state violence is routine, you're looking at well over a billion people for whom this most fundamental precondition for flourishing is simply not met.
I'll give you a different answer. Not because I think you're wrong, but because I think the question benefits from being looked at from multiple angles. I think the biggest gap is in what I'd call developmental potential. The combination of adequate nutrition in early childhood, access to basic education, and freedom from the kind of toxic stress that impairs cognitive and emotional development. This is the gap that determines whether the next generation can flourish, and it's self-perpetuating. Undernourished, uneducated, traumatized children become adults with diminished capabilities who raise undernourished, uneducated, traumatized children. It's the gap that makes all other gaps permanent.
That's not actually that far from my answer. Developmental potential is what safety enables. When you protect children from violence and provide basic nutrition and stimulation, you get developmental potential. When you don't, you get intergenerational poverty.
We're pointing at the same cluster of deprivations from different angles. You're emphasizing the proximal cause, the absence of safety, and I'm emphasizing the downstream effect, the foreclosure of human potential. It's the same tragedy described at different points in the causal chain.
That convergence is itself interesting. If you'd asked this question in 1990, you might have gotten very different answers. Clean water, perhaps, or primary healthcare. The fact that we're both circling around safety and developmental potential reflects how the understanding has evolved. We've made genuine progress on some of the classical basic needs. Extreme poverty has declined dramatically, child mortality is down, access to clean water has improved. But the needs that remain unmet are the harder ones, the ones that require functional institutions and social trust, not just technical interventions.
The low-hanging fruit has been picked. What's left are the needs that require political will and institutional transformation, not just aid shipments.
That's a sobering thought, because our track record on institutional transformation is mixed at best. It's easier to dig a well than to build a functioning justice system. It's easier to distribute food aid than to resolve a civil war. The needs that remain are the ones that resist technical solutions.
Which brings us to an uncomfortable question. If the remaining gaps are primarily political and institutional rather than technical, does the basic needs framework actually help? Or does it just give us a vocabulary for describing problems we don't know how to solve?
I think it helps in two ways. First, it keeps the focus on outcomes rather than inputs. A basic needs framework says we're not trying to build courts, we're trying to deliver safety. We're not trying to build schools, we're trying to deliver developmental potential. The institution is the means, not the end, and keeping that clear prevents the kind of bureaucratic self-perpetuation where the existence of a program becomes the measure of success.
Do we build a well that doesn't work, but we counted it as completed? Problem.
Second, a needs framework creates a basis for accountability. If you've agreed that safety is a basic human need, then governments that fail to provide it are failing at a fundamental obligation, not just performing poorly on one metric among many. It changes the register of the conversation from technocratic to moral.
That's the Sen Nussbaum move, reframing development from increasing GDP to expanding capabilities, which makes deprivation a justice issue rather than a technical glitch.
That reframing has been influential. When the UN adopted the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015, they were explicitly framed around ending poverty in all its forms and recognizing the multidimensional nature of deprivation. That's the capabilities approach filtering into global policy. It's incomplete and imperfect, but it's real.
To summarize where we've landed, the agreement on basic needs is broader than the textbook pyramid version suggests, but it's not total. There's consensus around nutrition, water, shelter, safety, and basic health as the floor. Beyond that, frameworks diverge on whether to include education, social belonging, political agency, dignity, and environmental stability. The understanding has evolved from a rigid hierarchy to a more dynamic, culturally sensitive, participatory model. And the biggest remaining gap globally, if we had to pick one, is probably in physical safety and the developmental potential it enables, affecting well over a billion people in ways that cascade through every other dimension of well-being.
That's a solid summary. I'd add one more thought, which is that the question of what's the biggest gap is itself a moving target. The gaps that loom largest today, safety, affiliation, developmental potential, are partly visible because we've made progress on older gaps. That's not cause for complacency, but it is cause for a certain kind of clarity. The problems we're failing to solve now are the hard ones. They require not just resources, but political courage, institutional patience, and a willingness to engage with the messiest dimensions of human life.
The easy problems were never easy. The hard problems are hard.
That's worth remembering when we're tempted by techno-optimist narratives about how AI or vertical farming or cryptocurrency are going to solve global poverty. The remaining gaps aren't primarily engineering problems. They're problems of power, trust, and collective action.
On that cheerful note, and now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, a British expedition in Somaliland nearly perished when a sudden katabatic wind, a gubin, as local Somali herders called it, swept down from the escarpment with such ferocity and heat that it killed dozens of pack camels and drove the party to the coast in a single desperate night march, abandoning most of their supplies. The expedition leader later wrote that the wind felt as though a furnace door had been opened across the entire horizon.
A furnace door across the entire horizon. That's a line.
Adding that to the mental file of things I hope to never experience.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.